This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. Seven Democratic candidates looking to win their party's nomination for president next year have stood behind the House of Representatives' decision to impeach President Donald Trump. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who will serve in the Senate trial of the president, said on PBS's broadcast that senators will have to put aside partisan leanings in the impeachment trial.
And everyone now in the Senate who's taken a constitutional oath to uphold our Constitution, and that doesn't mean loyalty to an individual, it doesn't mean loyalty to a political party, it means loyalty to our country.
The debate is the sixth in the race to pick a Democratic challenger to Trump. The seven candidates were the fewest to take part since the debates began. Meanwhile, the president said he wants an immediate trial in the Senate after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she would not hand off impeachment to the Senate until she learned how Republicans would manage the proceeding. Writing on Twitter, Trump said Thursday, "I want an immediate trial." But as AP's Washington bureau chief Julie Pace reports, Democrats are in no hurry.
They've put forward a couple of witnesses that they would like to see called, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, former National Security Advisor John Bolton. And so she is hoping that by holding this off, that they might move on some of this. And the reason why she is hopeful that she has even just a small bit of leverage is that President Trump wants this trial to happen. He wants to be acquitted on live television. He doesn't want the House impeachment to be the last act here. Certainly, if he is able to win re-election, even having been impeached, he will see that as real vindication. He will see that as a real sign that he can triumph over great adversity, over the biggest constitutional marker that is out there to curb his powers.
That's AP's Julie Pace. And this is VOA News. The United States is imposing sanctions on additional senior Iranian officials for human rights abuses as the Trump administration increases its maximum pressure campaign on the Tehran government. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo assailed Iranian officials for hypocrisy by depriving citizens, particularly ethnic and religious minorities, of their constitutional rights.
We're restricting visas for current or former Iranian officials and individuals responsible for or complicit in the abuse, detention, or killing of peaceful protesters.
Pompeo said he had redesignated Iran as a country of particular concern for religious freedom, a status that adds a layer of potential sanctions against the government. The secretary also said the administration would enact travel bans on officials found to have violated human rights, as well as their families. The U.S. Senate has approved a $1.4 trillion government spending package and sent it to the president's desk. We get details from AP's Mike Gracia.
The budget legislation heading to President Donald Trump's desk for his signature delivers an array of funding provisions for lawmakers on both sides of the aisle to take home in their Christmas stockings. The $1.4 trillion government spending package includes a major victory for the president in the form of $1.4 billion for his U.S.-Mexico border wall and the ability to tap other accounts for more funding. Democrats get domestic spending increases of $27 billion. The long-term cost to taxpayers is a roughly $400 billion increase in the federal deficit over 10 years. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a new North American trade deal on Thursday that includes tougher labor and automotive content rules, but leaves $1.2 trillion in annual U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade flows largely unchanged. The House vote sends the measure to the Senate, but it is not clear when the Republican-controlled chamber will take it up. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has said that consideration of the measure would likely follow an impeachment trial in the Senate, which is expected next month. The USMCA trade pact, first agreed upon last September, replaces the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. And the United States began flying Mexican deportees to the interior of Mexico on Thursday as the Trump administration seeks to further limit border crossings. Mexico said it had requested the flights to keep deportees away from dangerous border cities. A senior Homeland Security official said the flights were in response to the rising number of Mexican nationals arrested at the U.S.-Mexico border. For more on these stories and the rest of the day's news, be sure to visit voanews.com. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon's parliament passes a devolution bill for English-speaking regions, but the opposition says it is not enough.
That bill did not serve the Anglophones in any way, because they still came up with the positions of the gubernatorial orders where the governors to oversee the Anglophone region for the government will be doing.
Nijon Frundi is the founder and chairman of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. Fear of Boko Haram is fostering child marriages along Cameroon's border. The WHO says insecurity and lack of access remain major threats to ending the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. And a Ugandan judge issues a local arrest warrant for former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir.
The court found that in failing to arrest Omar al-Bashir on the two occasions he came to Uganda was a violation of Uganda's obligation under international law. Second, the court issued its own arrest warrant.
Two former senior managers at South Africa's embattled power utility Eskom were arrested Thursday for alleged fraud, and countries and companies attending this week's refugee forum pledged to boost support for green energy for refugees. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The founder and chairman of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party said his representatives in parliament have preliminarily rejected a bill passed by parliament to delegate some power to the country's English-speaking regions. If the bill is approved by the Senate, it would allow the Anglophone regions to develop their own education and judicial policies. More autonomy for Anglophone Cameroon was one of the recommendations of this year's national dialogue organized by President Paul Biya. SDF founder and chairman Nijon Frundi says the devolution bill does not serve the interests of Anglophone Cameroon.
That bill did not serve the Anglophones in any way, because they still came up with the positions of the gubernatorial orders where the governors to oversee the Anglophone region for the government will be doing. But the Anglophones, from my understanding, had wanted to have a situation where they will elect their own leaders in such a parliament. The SDF passed preliminary objections condemning that the bill did not serve the Anglophones in any way, because the SDF had proposed the Canadian option.
Mr. Frundi, what is the Canadian option?
That the Anglophones should be able to vote their own people, have the financial autonomy to be able to do their own things, than still waiting for the central government to send monies and send people to oversee the monies, how it's spent for you, which is what we totally reject.
At present, are governors in the Anglophone region appointed, or are they elected by the people?
The governors in the Anglophone region are appointed by Mr. Biya. And the Anglophones wanted a situation where they will elect governors or elect the people in positions of governors so that they control them.
So these governors, are they Anglophone people who are appointed by the president, or are they Francophone?
The president can appoint anybody from anywhere. Like we win the councils now, he appoints a government delegate. And the government delegate is answerable more to him. And he appoints the Secretary General of the Council, who is answerable to the president, not to the people. So with all this bottleneck that we've gone through, we thought that this could be straightened now for people to at least have some autonomy.
Mr. Frundi, for years and until recently, also October this year, there was this national conference, and this devolution bill was one of the recommendations made at the national conference. So why now reject it? You attended the national conference, did you?
Yeah, we attended the national conference hoping that we'll have something reasonable. For the fact that we attended the national conference does not mean that we'll accept everything that comes out of the national conference. We thought that Mr. Biya, in his good frame of mind, which he's never had, was going to at least have that call of conscience to think with sympathy on the Anglophone youth that are fighting and killing themselves in numbers in the bushes. But if he still has that stiff heart, then we rejected that bill.
If you say that this devolution bill doesn't go far, what happens now?
Well, we are still debating on that, and I have to have a press conference because I have to come out again for my medical checks.
In the meantime, February 2020 is approaching, and there's supposed to be new parliamentary and municipal elections. Are you participating in those?
Yes, we'll be participating conditionally, because we've told Mr. Biya that he should bring the situation in the north and southwest parts of the country under control, to call for a ceasefire, to let his soldiers put arms down, to make the conditions favorable for us to get into elections. And this is what we're looking forward onto.
Mr. Frundi, thank you very much again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Happy holidays to you.
I wish you a wonderful holiday, James.
Nijon Frundi is the founder and chairman of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He was speaking with us from Bamenda. More than a third of Cameroonian girls are married before the age of 18, but the highest rate is along the border with Nigeria, where 60% of girls go into child marriage. One of the reasons parents give for marrying off their daughters early is to protect them from the militant Islamic group Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has this report by Anne Unzuanku in Kwawa, Cameroon.
During a Boko Haram raid on the border town of Krawa Mafa 4 years ago, the Nigerian militants abducted Julie when she was just 13 years old. Now the girl whose name was changed to protect her is 17 years old and remembers when the Islamist group forced her to be one of their wives. Julie says one of the Boko Haram men told her he is going with her into the bush. She said no, she is a little girl, and asked what she would do in the bush. The man told her that she will become their wife. Julie begged the man to leave her alone and said she wanted to stay with her mother. "You killed my father and you want to take me to the bush," she exclaimed. "Leave me. I want to stay with my grandmother," Julie remembers telling them. Julie escaped Boko Haram during a clash with Cameroon's military and returned to her village. The militants' frequent attacks, however, raised fears that the group would come for her. So Julie's uncle, Varfa Etienne, married her to a 40-year-old man living 120 kilometers, that is about 75 miles, away to be his third wife. While showing a visiting reporter this month the properties Boko Haram destroyed, Etienne justified marrying off his niece by saying he has a lot of struggles. "I had a lot of farms before, and then Boko Haram took them," says Etienne. "I had goats. They came and took everything and destroyed the houses," he says. "Now I have nothing. I wanted my niece to be safe," says Etienne. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says while more than a third of Cameroonian girls are married before the age of 18 along the border with Nigeria, the rate jumps to 60%. While culture plays a role, parents say another reason is to protect their girls from Boko Haram. However, Cameroon's Ministry of Women's Empowerment and the Family says Boko Haram should not be used as an excuse for child marriage when parents could instead send their kids away to school. Elin Gele is a senior officer with the ministry.
Que vous soyez dans les zones d'insécurité, ou dans les zones pacifiées, ou dans les zones qui vivent dans la paix.
He says whether families are in insecure areas, in a pacified area, or in a peaceful area, the ideal for a child is to go to school and not into marriage. Parents must no longer use the pretext that the area is insecure, says Ngeli. 2 years ago, a neighbor helped rescue Julie by telling the Association for the Promotion of Autonomy and Rights of Girls and Women about her forced marriage. Now, in a shelter for child marriage victims, Julie takes classes for the first time. She says she wants to get a job and chose her own husband when she is ready. For Anne Zwanke in Krawa Mafa, Cameroon, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 20th. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Uganda's International Crimes Division Court has issued a local arrest warrant for deposed Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir. If he enters Uganda, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, has criticized Uganda in the past for hosting Mr. Bashir when he was president. Bashir is wanted by the court for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The Ugandan rights group Legal Brains Trust filed a petition in court saying the government's failure to arrest former Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir violated the Rome Statute, which Uganda has signed. Isaac Semakade is the petitioner's lawyer.
This kind of impunity is not acceptable because it offends. It offends the victims of injustice in Darfur, for whom the indictments are the first step to accessing justice. It shows that the government of Uganda does not respect the principle of equality, the principle of legality that all persons should be treated equally before the law. So some indictees are allowed to roam through Uganda.
Justice Henry Peter Adonyo, the head of Uganda's International Crimes Division, ruled Thursday morning that Uganda had failed its international obligations when it allowed Bashir to visit. The International Criminal Court indicted Bashir on charges of masterminding crimes against humanity in the Darfur region. Up to 300,000 people may have died and millions were displaced in a civil war that erupted there in 2003. The 75-year-old Bashir faces charges of murder, genocide, forcible transfer, extermination and rape, among others, according to ICC arrest warrants issued in 2010. However, he is now in jail in Sudan after having been convicted of corruption earlier this month. Nicholas Opio, a Ugandan human rights lawyer, was in court Thursday.
The court had five findings. First, the court found that in failing to arrest Omar al-Bashir on the two occasions he came to Uganda was a violation of Uganda's obligation under international law, namely under the Rome Statute, under the ICC Act in Uganda, and the UN Security Council Resolution 1593 of 2005. Second, the court issued its own arrest warrant and said if Omar al-Bashir comes within the territory under the control of Uganda in any time in the future, there's an arrest warrant issued by the court.
2 years ago, Uganda refused to arrest Bashir in Kampala on an ICC warrant. Uganda's government argued that it was not its duty to arrest a leader of a sovereign state who was officially invited into the country. Critics of that position say, as signatory to the Rome Statute, the treaty that established the ICC, Uganda had an obligation to arrest Bashir. Uganda is one of the countries referred to the United Nations Security Council for sanctioning over failing to arrest Bashir. Others are Russia, Jordan, and Chad. In April, Uganda expressed readiness to offer Bashir and his family asylum when the military forced him out of office after months of mass protests. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The World Health Organization says insecurity and lack of access in conflict-ridden parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo remain major threats to ending the Ebola outbreak there. The latest reports put the number of confirmed cases at 3,354, including 2,218 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Health officials are concerned progress made against the Ebola outbreak in the North Kivu and Ituri provinces could come undone because of ongoing fighting among dozens of armed groups. The World Health Organization says the deadly virus has been cleared from 25 of the region's health zones. It says an average of 4 to 10 new cases a week have been recorded in four zones in recent weeks. However, the executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, Mike O'Ryan, says there's been a big increase recently in the number of cases in North Kivu's Mabalako zone.
And last week, 4th to 10th of December, the number of cases jumped to 27 in a single week. So that's nearly a threefold increase, more than a threefold increase in 1 week, which is quite remarkable.
Ryan tells VOA the new cases are linked to a single chain of transmission stemming from one infected individual.
This case was a case most likely of a relapsed infection or someone who relapsed from having been previously recovered. And this has occurred in an area that's quite insecure and been very difficult to operate in. And it's most worrying because one of the contacts from that transmission chain ended up moving to Butembo and died in Butembo.
Ryan recalls that 6 months ago, Ebola was raging in Butembo, which is also in North Kivu. He says there is real concern that continued transmission of the virus in Mabalako could potentially reinfect Butembo, which would be a major setback to Ebola containment efforts. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Two former senior managers who worked at South Africa's Embato power utility, Eskom, and other business executives were arrested Thursday on allegations of fraud, corruption, and money laundering totaling $51 million. The arrest come at a time when Eskom is failing to produce enough electricity, leaving people's lives and the economy at risk. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, where the suspects have already appeared in court.
The Serious Commercial Crimes Investigative Unit says the two former Eskom senior managers, two business directors and representatives of seven companies were arrested after suspicions were raised in the construction of two large power stations. The unit, which collaborated with the National Prosecuting Authority in arresting the group, alleges that they were involved in manipulating contracts among contractors, Eskom employees and third parties. The arrest warrants allege that between February 2015 and July 2017, the suspects shared approximately $2 million among themselves. It's further alleged they manipulated procurement systems and reduced contract deliverables without justification. In addition, the warrants say there was a conflict of interest with some employees. Subcontractors allegedly were used as conduits to channel kickback payments to Eskom managers. The two power stations, Medupi and Kusile, are millions of dollars over budget, yet they have struggled to work at full capacity. Hangwani Mulaudzi is the spokesperson of the Special Investigative Unit, the WOCS.
The case is part and parcel of the main case that we're dealing at Eskom. There's a lot of irregular agreements that were made, which did manage to see many other companies coming in. Eskom was not even supposed to be part and parcel of those agreements that were signed, but those two officials were through their influence.
Some energy experts say the construction of the two plants, instead of solving the country's power woes, has added to them. While the initial price tag for the two stations was $12 billion, the delays have pushed it to an estimated $32 billion. Some construction experts say corruption has taken a large share of that amount. The power utility, which has a debt of close to $32 billion, has survived on government bailouts. Its failure to provide enough electricity has frustrated President Cyril Ramaphosa's economic development initiatives, prompting economists to sound recession warning bells. In recent weeks, some mining companies had to temporarily shut down after Eskom was forced to cut generation, leading to power cuts that lasted up to 8 hours in some places. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Countries and companies attending a refugee forum in Geneva this week pledged to boost support for green energy for refugees, among other goals. Findings show renewables offer multiple benefits, including reducing some of the root causes of displacement. Lisa Bryant reports on what this means for Africa, which hosts roughly one quarter of the world's refugees.
Access to energy is one of the biggest challenges facing Africa, especially for one of its most vulnerable groups, refugees. Energy is crucial for cooking and heat and to power refugee schools and health clinics. Getting it often means cutting trees for firewood and charcoal. That's a problem in countries like Ethiopia, which hosts nearly 1 million refugees. The Ethiopian Refugee Agency's Director for Humanitarian Assistance, Fiseha Misret Kindi, was at this week's Refugee Forum.
The hosting communities are shouldering those burdens because there is an environmental degradation and depletion because of hosting many refugees.
Well, the current situation for energy in Africa is pretty poor, pathetic.
Andrew Harper is Climate Action Special Advisor for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
That was Mr. Brian reporting, and it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sporting. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with news from the Council for East and Central African Football Association's competition, where host Uganda Cranes beat Eritrea 3-0 to win a record 15th CECAFA Senior Challenge title on Thursday. Goals from Bright Anukani, Mustafa Kiza and Joel Madondo saw Uganda Cranes dispatch a determined Eritrean side. Uganda Cranes coach Jonathan McKinstry after the game said he was happy that his boys worked hard and won the trophy.
We knew coming into this game that Eritrea would be a tough opponent. And really we got what we expected. High energy, some excellent passing. And we knew we needed to be well organized. And I think we did that reasonably well. We denied them any real chances.
From East Africa to West Africa, where in fulfillment of the International Olympic Committee policy that all national Olympic committees must have women in sports commission, the Ghana Olympic Committee has inaugurated a women's commission. The role of the commission is, among others, to promote equal opportunities for girls and women to participate in and benefit from sports and physical activities. Ben Nuno Mensah, the president of the Ghana Olympic Committee, believes that women taking up leadership positions will change the fortunes of the International Olympic Committee.
The role of Ghana's women in sports commission will therefore be to advise the Ghana Olympic Committee board and the president on the development and implementation of policies to promote equal opportunity for girls and women to participate in and benefit from sports and physical activity.
In athletics, the Confederation of African Athletics said on Thursday it will revive the Pan-African Athletics Tour in 2020 in the bid to cushion the continent's athletes after a snub by World Athletics Diamond League. The announcement is part of the CAA to cushion its athletes after a majority will lose out in 2020 when the new Diamond League new format rolls out. World Athletics has already confirmed that 3,000 meters steeplechase, 5,000 meters, discus throw, triple jump, and 200 meters have been asked as core events for the 2020 IWAF Diamond League. Confederation of African Athletics President Hamad Malbun Kalkaba confirmed that 6 cities have been selected for the one-day meeting, which will offer African athletes another stage to compete at the international level and earn money. And finally, in basketball news, FIBA Africa has issued the procedure for the FIBA AfroBasket 2021 qualifiers that will take place later today at the Kigali Arena. Africa's premier basketball tournament will now take place every 4 years instead of the usual biennial event. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, December 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
It's summertime in the Southern Hemisphere. But if you're north of the equator, Border Crossings will bring you some warmth with our Psychedelic Sunshine Show. You'll hear from the best Californian musicians of the 60s, like Sonny and Cher, the Monkees, and the Beach Boys. Help me wonder, yeah. Tune into Border Crossings on December 19th for the grooviest songs in the world. Only on The Voice of America.